planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دید اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری میگه ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون این هم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. So we said, one, when he goes to the bathroom, he has to keep in mind that he needs to be very cautious of urine not falling on his clothes. Before I continue, the laws and regulations and etiquettes of lavatory, there are too many to mention. You'll find many of them in the books of laws and rulings, what we call Minhaj al-Salihin, and some you'll find in books of Akhlaq. And so there are many of them. From the minute you step in to the minute you walk out, there are many things need to be considered. We're just going to take a few things here, though. So we're not going to mention everything because that will be a very, very long episode. So one, a person needs to be cautious when it comes to matter of urine. The other thing Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi says, al-wudu'u ba'da al-tuhuru ashru hasanat fatatahharu. He said, purifying yourself after going to the bathroom, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you 10 rewards or 10 deeds. Therefore, purify yourself. Now, in the ahadith, at many times they use the word wudu'. Sometimes our mind straight away goes to ablution. It goes to ablution when we trying to perform wudu for salah. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi here, he says, if you go to the bathroom, before you come out, make sure you wash your hands. Because he gives a direct order, fatatahharu, do purify yourselves. So don't just walk out. So we need to make sure that our hands are clean before we walk out of the bathroom. So washing is not just a recommended action, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, according to this hadith, he will give you 10 rewards. All right? So also that's something that we need to keep in mind. Another hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, إِذَا أَتَى الْخَلَاءَ لَا يَمْسَحُ بِيَمِينَهُ. When the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam goes to the bathroom, he does not use his right hand to purify himself. He would use his left, right? Because the right hand is the hand we eat with. The right hand is most of the times we do everything with our right. So it has kind of a special notion to it. So therefore, we should not use it to purify and cleanse ourselves if we are doing number one or number two, and especially when doing number two. So we need to use our left hand rather than our right. So the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he never used his right hand when he goes to the bathroom. So that's something that me and you, we have to keep in mind. So now, we have three things we discussed so far. One, when we go to the bathroom, we have to be very cautious of urine that does not sprinkle and falls on our clothes. Two, we should use our left hand to purify ourselves, not our right hand. And three, before we walk out, we have to make sure that we do wash our hands. That's just one of the keys of life in terms of keeping ourselves clean and pure. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernandez, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, "If it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar." The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister, Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive. Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the U.S. and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the U.S. dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of U.S. dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the U.S. dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of U.S. dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999. While the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like SCO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the U.S. dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years.
The United States and yet again another shooting with mass fatalities. Around a dozen people were killed and about the same number were injured in a mass shooting in the largely Asian city of Monterey in Southern California. Eyewitnesses said the assailant opened fire indiscriminately with a semi-automatic weapon at an event in Monterey Park as the local community was celebrating Chinese Lunar New Year. Captain Andrew Mayer of L.A. Sheriff's Department said officers had responded to emergency calls at around 10:20 p.m. on Saturday and found people pouring out of the premises. He said the officers made entry to the location and located additional victims. Police say the victims were transported to numerous local hospitals and were listed in various conditions from stable to critical. Witnesses said there was a shooter with a machine gun who had multiple rounds of ammunition on him so he could reload. It is still unknown whether the suspect knew his victims or whether it was a targeted attack. Investigations are underway into the shooting to find out the motive behind it and whether or not the incident was a hate crime. But the factors that lead to tragedies like the one in Monterey Park are deeply ingrained in U.S. politics, culture, and law. As defined by the Gun Violence Archive, a mass shooting is an incident during which four or more people are shot. The Monterey incident is the 33rd such mass shooting that has taken place in the U.S. already since the beginning of this year. It follows shootings at an MLK Day celebration in Fort Pierce, Florida, and a shooting that killed six people in Goshen, California on that very same day. The Monterey shooting also follows numerous such events last year, including at a Walmart in Virginia, the one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a shooting on a school bus allegedly targeting members of the University of Virginia football team, and a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois last summer. The United States experienced 647 mass shootings last year, illustrating the severity of the issue with guns. The mass shootings in the U.S. come as no other country has suffered such a high death toll from gun violence. Every day, more than 110 Americans die at the end of a gun, including suicides and homicides, an average of more than 40,000 per year. In 2020 alone, more than 45,000 Americans died at the end of a gun, whether by homicide or suicide, more than any other year on record. In terms of the number of incidents, since 2009, there has been an annual average of 19 shootings in which at least 4 people are killed. The U.S. gun homicide rate is as much as 26 times that of other high-income countries. Its gun suicide rate is nearly 12 times higher. This, as gun control opponents have typically framed the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. as a symptom of a broader mental health crisis. Every country has people with mental health issues and extremists. Those problems aren't unique. What is unique in the U.S.'s expansive view of civilian gun ownership, ingrained in politics, in culture, and in the law since the nation's founding, and a national political process that has so far proved incapable of changing that norm. In terms of the number of guns in the U.S. and how they contribute to the related violence, one estimate from the Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 390 million guns in circulation in the U.S. in 2018, or about 120.5 firearms per 100 residents. More recent data also suggests that gun ownership grew significantly over the last several years. One study published by the Annals of Internal Medicine in February found that 7.5 million U.S. adults, just under 3% of the population, became first new gun owners between January 2019 and April 2021. But what are the causes of gun violence in the U.S.? Easy access to firearms, a lack of comprehensive background checks and regulations, social and economic factors such as poverty, racism, and mental illness could be named as such. When it comes to the National Rifle Association, the NRA lobbies heavily against all forms of gun control and argues that more guns make the country safer. Despite years of financial woes and internal strife, the NRA remains the most powerful gun lobby in the United States, with a substantial budget to influence members of Congress on gun policy. In January, the NRA filed for bankruptcy as part of a fraud case against some of its own senior staff. Over the last several election cycles, the NRA and other organizations have consistently spent more on pro-gun rights messaging than their rivals in the gun control lobby. Who supports gun control? Despite widespread and vocal public outrage, often in the wake of gun violence, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014, according to polling by Gallup. 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. 11% surveyed said laws should be made less strict. Last year, Congress reached a deal on limited gun reforms for the first time in nearly 30 years, but the recent shootings underscored just how embedded gun violence is in the U.S. To the solutions, some argue for stricter gun control laws, such as universal background checks, banning certain types of weapons, and increasing funding for mental health services. Others argue for a more permissive approach, such as loosening restrictions on gun ownership and emphasizing the importance of the Second Amendment.
fractures are appearing in the Ukraine conflict between the Western backers of the war, first amongst themselves, then with Ukraine. Even though some 50 nations agreed to provide Kyiv with billions of dollars worth of military hardware, including armored vehicle and munitions needed to push back Russian forces, Germany has refused to provide Ukraine with Leopard tanks. Not only that, it has prevented other nations from transferring these tanks to Ukraine by countries that have them in their possession. The new German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said that despite heightened expectations, we still cannot say when a decision will be taken and what the decision will be when it comes to the Leopard tanks. This has angered Ukraine, which blasted the global indecision of its allies after Germany's refusal. A Ukrainian presidential advisor tweeted, "Today's indecision is killing more of our people. Every day of delay is the death of Ukrainians. Think faster." It appears that the main disagreement lies between the US and Germany, which has indicated that it would agree to do so only if the US provided its Abrams tanks as well. Washington has said providing its Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. This disagreement has led to friction within the circle of US congressmen. US Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has called on both countries to supply the machines. To the Germans, he said send the tanks to Ukraine because they need them. It is in your national interest that Russian President Vladimir Putin loses in Ukraine. To the US President Joe Biden administration, he said send American tanks so that others will follow our lead. Military assistance to Ukraine has continued unabated in recent weeks and months. The headline reads, "Europe is gearing up to send Western tanks to Ukraine." It almost sounds like the warring parties are just getting warmed up to the conflict, that the war has entered a new phase. One conclusion could be that Ukraine is losing the war on the ground since it continues to seek more military assistance, and what it has received so far has not been enough to defeat the Russian forces. This, however, will not deter NATO and a number of individual member states who have pledged to provide heavier weapons to Ukraine. US's cautious stance may be that it does not want to fall into a direct conflict with Russia. That could also mean that it may risk defeat or that this risks getting into a nuclear confrontation. Russia's reaction to countries that are going to provide Ukraine with tanks was a warning. Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, has said Kyiv's foreign backers do not care about Ukrainian lives and are motivated by their desire to hurt Russia. Those tanks can burn and will burn like the rest of the weapons. The nations supplying them are using Ukraine as an instrument in achieving their anti-Russian goals. Russia has also stated that this is no longer a war between Russia and Ukraine, but a war between Russia and US and NATO. But what the Ukrainian defense minister said has been very telling. He tweeted recently, "We are carrying out NATO's mission today. They aren't shedding their blood. We are shedding ours. That's why they are required to supply us with weapons." All that brings everyone to the question, when will Ukrainians realize their country is being sacrificed for the sake of the US weakening Russia?
Zamir Kabulov, Russia's presidential envoy to Afghanistan, says that the U.S. has been reaching out to the Taliban's opposition groups, such as Daesh, and secretly giving money to them. He describes the reasoning for this covert support as such: because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation, they do everything so that peace isn't established in this troubled land. He further linked this move to Russia's security by saying, "With the armed opposition in Afghanistan, the Anglo-Saxons are covertly sponsoring Daesh, who are aimed at undermining not only the stability of our Central Asian partners, but also the security of Russia." Allegations of the U.S. supporting Daesh in particular have been around for a decade at this point. Sometimes they even come from U.S. officials.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is among the top officials that accused the United States of backing Daesh. Erdogan made the accusations in response to U.S. accusations against his government for supporting terrorist groups. He said, "Now they give support to terrorist groups including Daesh, YPG, PYD. It is very clear. We have confirmed evidence with pictures, photos, and videos." In a 3-year field study into the supply chain of Daesh, it was found that the arming and external funding that anti-Assad rebel groups received from the US found their way into the hands of Daesh. With all the accusations on America's direct involvement in the founding of Daesh, the indirect involvement that most of the world agrees resulted in the creation of the terror group is the quote-unquote power vacuum that the US left in the region by fighting the many wars it fought, especially the invasion of Iraq and the support of Syrian rebel groups. The US effectively fought a war in Afghanistan for 20 years with a budget of over $2.1 trillion to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. The Taliban has been accused of many things since their swift power grab back in August of 2021, but what they have managed to do is stabilizing the country and ridding it of power struggles. That means groups like Daesh, who still have a presence in the region, weren't able to establish bases in Afghanistan, despite still carrying out terrorist attacks for a while after Taliban's takeover, the number of which have significantly dropped over the last year. Now, with around 97% of the population of Afghanistan below poverty line, and with half of the country's billions of dollars worth of foreign assets frozen by the US, the last thing the country can afford is US shenanigans trying to prop up Takfiri terrorist groups there. Recently, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken poured salt on the wounds of Afghanistan by justifying the way the U.S. left Afghanistan by saying, if the forces had remained there, quote, "it would have, I think, made much more complicated the support that we've been able to give and that others have been able to give Ukraine." Almost as if Afghanistan was a pawn in the grand scheme of US's political agendas, an attitude that isn't too uncommon in US politics with all of their friends and foes. Instances of such attitude are numerous, from the promise of retaliation to Saudi Arabia over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and then doing nothing about it because Saudi Arabia is a strategic partner to the US, to using Taiwan as a means to get under China's skin that could lead to a conflict wherein Taiwan will turn into a pawn for US's political games.
In the limelight.
Hidden violence by police forces in Western countries is far more than developing countries, including those in West Asia and even Africa. This may be related to the complexity of the nature of crime and the definition of criminal behavior, as well as the police's view of these countries to humans as useful creatures for industrial society. One of the countries in which police commit lots of violence is Britain. In recent years, there has been many news about it. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more.
¶¶
Tehran Times wrote in this regard, "In every community, the police are considered to be the symbol of peace and security. There are few societies in which citizens are afraid of seeing the police, and this is rooted in the name of the police, which comes from the Greek word polis, which means city and civility. A police officer is actually a law enforcement officer, but in the modern world, especially in recent years, some policemen's behavior towards citizens has been very harsh, in violation of basic human rights. One of the countries in which police commit lots of violence is Britain. The name of the British police today is associated with violence, rape, and abuse. With a simple search on the internet, you can find the most harrowing stories of British police that look more like crime books." Some instances of police violence are organized and some others are a result of the spirit of violence among the Metropolitan Police Forces. Today in England, a Metropolitan Police Officer, even if he is off duty, allows himself to handcuff a young girl for not complying with the restrictions of Corona, put her in his car, rape her, and kill her. That girl was none other than Sarah Everard, who was killed in March 2021, and the police officer was none other than Wayne Cousins. Another case in this regard is the case of David Carrick. He is a serving officer in London's Metropolitan Police, who has admitted to 49 offences, including 24 counts of rape over an 18-year period. David Carrick appeared at Southwark Crown Court in the British capital on January 16, 2022, to plead guilty for 4 counts of rape, false imprisonment, and indecent assault relating to a 40-year-old woman in 2003. The UK's PA Media News Agency has reported this. According to CNN, on January 16, 2023, at the Old Bailey Criminal Court in London last month, Carrick admitted to 43 charges against 11 other women, including 20 counts of rape, between March 2004 and September 2020, according to PA. A series of recent scandals has shed light on what the UK police watchdog called a culture of misogyny and racism in London's police service. The Metropolitan Police Service Commissioner Cressida Dick resigned from her post in 2022 after a damning review by the Independent Office for Police Conduct issued 15 recommendations to change policing practice in the country. London's Metropolitan Police are now investigating as many as 1,000 sex offences and domestic abuse claims involving approximately 800 of its officers, the force's commissioner Mark Rowley admitted recently. Rowley said in an interview with UK media, "That's 1,000 cases to look at. Some of those will be things of no concern in the end when we look at them, because it will be an argument overheard by neighbors where inquiries show there is nothing to be concerned about." Women's rights organizations called for an inquiry into the Met following Carrick's case. UK domestic abuse charity Refugee called Carrick's crimes utterly abhorrent. Refugee tweeted recently, "When a man who has been charged with 49 offences, including 24 charges of rape, is a serving police officer, how can women and girls possibly be or feel safe? This is an institution in crisis." That Carrick's pattern of egregious behaviour was known to the Met and they failed to act speaks more loudly than their empty promises to women. UK organization End Violence Against Women, tweeted. It added, "Solidarity with the victims and all who are feeling the weight of the traumatic details being reported." The British Women's Equality Party tweeted, "Mets knew about the allegations for 20 years. They did nothing as a serial rapist abused his power. They are complicit. Misogyny will never be stripped from the police without a nationwide statutory inquiry." The Favicit Society, which campaigns for gender equality and women's rights, said on Twitter, "Any act of sexual violence is a disgrace, but it is particularly harmful when, yet again, these crimes have been perpetrated by a person who has additional responsibilities to keep the public safe." Along with women, the groups that have suffered the most from the British police are the black people and those with Asian origin. 1,833 police have died in police custody or following police contact in the UK since 1990, British media reported on September 27, 2022. The killing of Chris Kebbah has led to renewed calls for justice as black people continued to be disproportionately targeted by police violence. Father-to-be Chris Kebbah, 24, was unarmed when he was shot through a car windscreen in Streatham Hill on September 5, 2022 by a Met police officer. Metropolitan police officers are four times more likely to use force against black people compared with the white population, new figures suggest. The Met used force 62,000 times in 2017 to 2018, with more than a third of incidents involving black people. Techniques such as verbal instructions and using firearms are recorded. The Met police said, "The proportionate use of force is essential in some circumstances to protect the public and often themselves from violence." Shadow Home Secretary Diane Abbott said that disproportionate use of force is discriminatory. Police forces in Britain have been required to keep a detailed record of each time an officer used force since April 1, 2017. According to the data, a black person in London is four times likely than a white person to have force used against them by a Met police officer as a proportion of the population. London's black population at the last census was 1,088,447. In 2017 to 2018, the Met used force 22,989 times against black people. Based on population figures, the use of force was equivalent to once for every 50 black people in Greater London and once for every 200 of the white population. This is higher than in other police forces covering large urban areas such as Greater Manchester and Merseyside.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Glory be to him who created all the pairs of what the earth produces and of themselves and what they know not. The Holy Quran, chapter 36, ayah 36. The Almighty God has created everything, everything. He created all the pairs. There are pairs in human beings, animals, and in plants. And of what they know not. There are also some things that are in pairs, which we are unaware of. For example, how pairs are formed within rocks. This may be discovered in the future. The celestial bodies are in pairs. How? We don't know yet. This will be discovered in the future. You see, glory be to him who created the pairs of what the earth produces and of themselves and of what they know not. So that was about pairs. The verse I read was from Surah Yasin. It is also mentioned in another verse of the Holy Quran in Surah Adh-Dhariyat. In all things we have created pairs, so that you may take admonition. The Holy Quran, Surah 51, Ayah 49.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The law of pairs is a universal law. I would like to mention another point here on the side of our discussion. This pairing that is so obvious in the Islamic viewpoint is exactly the opposite point of the contradiction in the Hegelian and Marxist dialectics. The main pillar of Hegel's dialectic, which Marx later took from him, is contradiction. It implies that the movement of society, history, and humanity are caused by contradictory processes between opposite sides. That is, there is thesis and antithesis, and thin thesis is formed from thesis and antithesis. This is not the case in Islam. Synthesis is not formed from antithesis, it is created from pairing. It is pheron pairing, compatibility and companionship, that the next position, the next generation and the next movement and next stage is born. Of course, this needs to be analyzed and works needs to be done on this. What I said here is a theory, it is a viewpoint. So pairing is a universal law in the world of creation.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for
in the limelight.
Even though the economic strength of Western peripheral states will continue to decline, Washington's pressure on them to push forward with the U.S.-centric agenda is unlikely to decrease. Peripheral Western states should focus on internal issues, not promote U.S. interests. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, "The U.S. is desperately trying to retain its global hegemony. The American empire's economic and political overstretching is adding significant pressure on peripheral countries designated to serve U.S. imperialist interests. Examining developments in the foreign policies of Australia, Canada, Britain, and Sweden, it appears that these peripheral states have miscalculated the durability of U.S. hegemony and its longevity. Instead of focusing on serious internal problems, these states are getting involved in adventures which do not apply to the realities of the multipolar world order of today." Take the case of Australia and Papua New Guinea. On January 12th, the leaders of the two neighboring countries announced that they are negotiating a security treaty that will be signed in June. This is aimed supposedly at countering China's growing regional influence. Last September, Australia, the US, and Britain announced a new trilateral security alliance with emphasis on the fact that Australia will be sold submarines which would carry nuclear weapons. Australia is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, that prohibits the spread of nuclear weapons. But it seems when U.S. empire's interests are involved, any law or treaty can be discarded to suit Washington's ambitions. Even if one were to accept Australia's security concerns at face value, how will Papua New Guinea's 3,000 man army bolster Australia's stance against China from a security angle is hard to see. Australia has been involved in Papua New Guinea since the tiny South Pacific island gained independence in 1975. If Australian investment, through which Canberra camouflages its meddling in the country, were directed at actual development, more than half of Papua New Guinea's population would not still be living in poverty. Recently, Canada has also been making announcements which hint at Ottawa's meddling beyond its borders, namely in Haiti. Ottawa's disruptive meddling in Haiti is not going unnoticed among Canadians. Considering the rising level of poverty in Canada, people have expressed deep concern and want to see Canadian resources utilized at home. While experiencing colossal internal problems from healthcare to the economy, Britain has also intensified its hostile rhetoric against Islamic Iran by meddling in its internal affairs. Sweden's enthusiastic drive to join NATO is meant to appeal to the Washington crafted stance on Russia rather than internal Swedish dynamics. Often seen as a benchmark of how to manage a country properly, Sweden has witnessed a significant increase in bankruptcies recently. These developments hint at circumstances where peripheral Western states are becoming too invested in schemes aimed at securing the U.S.-centric global order rather than improving the condition of their own people. Some years ago, these peripheral states could justify the economic cost of their foreign policy adventurism. Today, their economies neither have the stamina nor the status to sell such adventurism to their populations as justified state policy. Even though the economic strength of Western peripheral states will continue to decline, Washington's pressure on them to push forward with the U.S.-centric agenda is unlikely to decrease. Empires in decline become particularly vicious. This situation will likely create bigger rifts between the U.S. and its traditional allies. This can already be observed to a certain degree in the relationship between France and the U.S. on how to proceed with the war in Ukraine. Cracks with Germany are also beginning to appear. The sooner the Western countries recalibrate their policies and attitudes in accordance with the realities of a multipolar order, the sooner global tensions will abate. This will benefit everyone and not serve merely the whims of a dying empire. Global Times also noted from the perspective of the U.S., a multipolar world demonstrates the U.S. relative decline, yet Washington's problems do not lie in external factors but internal. Fundamentally speaking, the system design at the initial stage of its founding was based on an agricultural society. Now that the world has already entered the information era beyond the industrial age, this institutional system must undergo major changes, but today the U.S. has entered a political deadlock where almost no change can be taken. The election of the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, which is a routine procedure, took 15 excruciating rounds of voting. There were certainly huge deals and negotiations behind. Take the important but long criticized electoral system. In practice, it has caused two evil results. First, there are many instances of politicians winning despite receiving fewer votes from ordinary voters, leading to questions about the legitimacy of the president and even the system. Second, populist figures can use the system to gain power. Today, the U.S. is unable to adjust even the voting time, not to mention the electoral system. Moreover, the political landscape is becoming increasingly solidified. The number of voters in the middle has shrunk sharply, and political opposition and extremes have become mainstream. In 2022 midterm elections, the expected red wave did not appear. Likewise, in 2020, the expected blue wave did not emerge. Each side won narrowly. The background of 2020 presidential election is Donald Trump's failure to respond to the COVID-19 epidemic. In 2022, prices were soaring and people's lives were severely impacted. It stands to reason that health and life are issues that the public attaches great importance to, and that should be reflected in elections, but this was not the case. Obviously, in the current politics of the U.S., ability and the mortality of politicians are no longer important. What determines everything is the stance. The extreme development is Trump's refusal to recognize the election results in 2020. In fact, the root cause of the problems in the U.S. is clear. According to an AP NORC survey published last year, the majority of Americans believe the country is heading in the wrong direction. However, facing the problem, the U.S. prescribes the wrong medicine and goes against the trend of history. As Singapore's former foreign minister George Yeo commented, the U.S. doesn't like multipolarity and is fighting it. My fear is it will exhaust itself fighting because it will fail.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hundreds of protesters took to the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad to denounce the desecration of Quran in Sweden.
The blasphemous act was carried out by a hardline Swedish politician on Saturday. He was guarded by police forces when he set fire to a copy of the Holy Quran in Stockholm.
Holding banners and placards with anti-West slogans, the protesters, including religious scholars, traders, and rights activists, demanded the UN to slam the incident.
We are here to condemn in the strongest possible terms the vile attack on our holy book. Permitting this anti-Islam act, which targets Muslims and insults our sacred values on the grounds of freedom of expression, is entirely unacceptable.
Islam is a religion of peace, and we believe in the need to respect all beliefs. These principles must be supported by all. The West has been trying to hurt the feelings of Muslims by desecrating our Prophet as well as our holy book Quran in the recent past. This should be stopped now.
Sweden is facing the outrage of Muslim countries including Iran, Turkey, Pakistan, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, in which people denounced the Scandinavian nation for the incident. The Pakistani protesters called it a senseless and provocative Islamophobic act that hurts the religious sentiments of over 1.5 billion Muslims across the globe.
We will not accept the discretion of our religious beliefs. Such actions are not covered under any legitimate expression of the right to freedom of speech or opinion. The West is trying to create anarchy in the Islamic world by hurting their religious beliefs, which is condemnable and unacceptable.
Similar protest demonstrations were also held in major cities and towns of Pakistan.
Pakistan has called on the international community to take measures against Islamophobia and sacrilegious acts against Muslim sanctities. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional €500 million military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of 49 billions is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical